visible, although I admit that it was difficult to determine its exterior from its interior as it pulsed and throbbed and changed shape from second to second, almost like a starship morphing for battle. The thing had no head as such, not even a flattened, squid-like extension that might be considered a head. But I could make out a variety of tentacles, although fronds or filaments might be better words for the constantly swaying, retracting, extending, and quivering appendages. But these filaments were inside the pale, clear body as much as outside, and I was not sure if the creature's movement through the clear air was a result of the swimming motion of the filaments, or because of gases expelled as the giant cuttlefish expanded and contracted. As far as I could recall from old books and Grandam's explanations, the zeppelins on Whirl were much simpler in appearance. Blimp-shaped gas bags, more Medusa-like cells to hold their mix of hydrogen and methane, storing and metabolizing helium in their crude lift sacks, giant jellyfish floating in the hydrogen-ammonia-methane atmosphere of Whirl. As best as I could remember, the zeppelins ate a sort of atmospheric phytoplankton that floated in the noxious atmosphere like so much airborne manna. There were no predators on Whirl, until humans arrived in their floating bathyscaphs to harvest the rarer gases. As the cuttlefish creature grew closer, I saw the complexity of its innards, pale, pulsing outlines of organs, and intestine-looking coils, and what might be feeding filaments, and tubes that might be for reproduction or elimination. And there were some appendages that might be sex organs, or perhaps eyes. And all the while it folded in on itself, retracted its curling filaments, then pulsed forward, tentacles extended fully, like a squid swimming through clear water. It was 500 or 600 meters long. I began to notice the other things. Around the cuttlefish swarmed hundreds or thousands of golden disc-shaped creatures, ranging in size from tiny ones, perhaps as large as my hand, to others larger than the heavy river mantas used to pull barges on Hyperion's rivers. These things were also nearly transparent, although their insides were clouded by a sort of greenish glow that might have been an inert gas excited to luminescence by the animal's own bioelectrical field. These things swarmed around the cuttlefish, at times appearing to be swallowed or absorbed by some orifice or another, only to reappear outside again. I could not swear that I saw the cuttlefish eating any of the swarming discs, but at one point I thought that I could see a cloud of the green glowing things moving along the inside of the cuttlefish's gut, like ghostly platelets in a clear vein. The monster and its cloud of companions floated closer, rising until the sunlight passed through its body on its way to light my kayak and parasail. I revised its size upward. It must be at least a click long and a third that in width when it expanded to its widest. The living discs floated to each side of me now. I could see that they were spinning as well as curling like mantas. I tugged out the flechette pistol Alem had given me and clicked off its safety. If the monster attacked, I would fire half the magazine of slivers into its pale side, hoping that it was as thin as it was transparent. Maybe there was a chance that I could spill whatever lift gases allowed it to float in this band of oxygen atmosphere. At that moment, the thing's hydra-like filaments flashed out in all directions, some missing my parasail by mere meters, and I realized that I could never kill or sink the monster before it destroyed my sail with one thrash of one tentacle. I waited, half expecting to be pulled into the cuttlefish's maw, if it had a maw, at any second. Nothing happened. My kayak floated in the direction I thought of as westward, the parasail rising on thermals and descending on colder downdrafts. The clouds towering around me and the cuttlefish and its companions, I thought of them as parasites for no good reason, stood off a few hundred meters to the north and 100 meters or so above me. I wondered if the thing was following me out of curiosity or hunger. I wondered if the green platelets drifting around me might attack at any moment. Capable of doing nothing else, I laid the useless flechette pistol on my lap, nibbled on the last of my biscuits from my pack, and sipped from my water bottle. I had less than another day's supply of water. I cursed myself for not trying to catch rainwater during the night's terrible storm, although I had no idea if this world's water was potable. The long morning grew into a long afternoon. Several times the drifting parasail took me into a cloud tower, and I raised my face to the dripping fog, licking droplets from my lips and chin. The water tasted like water. Each time I emerged from the fog, I expected the cuttlefish to have departed. But each time it remained on station to my right and above me. Once, just after the halo that was the sun above had passed the zenith, the kayak was blown into a particularly rough patch of climbing cloud, and the parasail almost folded in the violent updraft. But it stabilized itself, and when I emerged from the cloud that time, I was some kilometers higher. The air was thinner and colder. The cuttlefish had followed me up. Perhaps it's not hungry yet. Perhaps it feeds after dark. I reassured myself with a series of these thoughts. I kept scanning the empty sky between clouds for another farcaster ring, but none appeared. It seemed folly to expect to find one. The air currents blew me generally westward, but the vagaries of the jet stream sent me clicks north and south. How could I thread such a small needle after a day and night and day of blowing around like this? It did not seem likely, but still I searched the sky. In mid-afternoon I realized that there were other living things visible far below to the south. More cuttlefish moving about the base of an immense cloud tower, the sunlight piercing the depths enough to illuminate their clear bodies against the black of the broiling depths beneath them. There must be scores, no, hundreds of the pulsing, swimming things along the base of that one cloud. I was too far away to make out the platelet parasites around them, but a sense of diffused light there, like dust floating, suggested their presence by the thousands or millions. I wondered if the monsters usually kept to the lower atmospheric levels, and this one, still keeping pace with me within feeding filament range, had ventured up out of curiosity. My muscles were cramping. I pulled myself out of the cockpit and tried stretching along the top of the kayak's hull, hanging onto the parasail risers to keep my balance. It was dangerous, but I had to stretch. I lay on my back and pedaled an imaginary bicycle with my raised legs. I did push-ups, clinging to the rim of the cockpit for balance. When I had worked most of the cramps out, I crawled back into the cockpit and half-dozed. Perhaps it is odd to admit, but my mind wandered all that afternoon, even while the alien cuttlefish swam alongside within swallowing range, and alien platelet creatures danced and hovered within meters of the kayak and parasail. The human mind gets used to strangeness very quickly if it does not exhibit interesting behavior. I began thinking about the past few days, and the past months, and the past years. I thought of Ania, of leaving her behind, and of all the other people I had left behind. A. Betic and the others at Taliesin West, the old poet on Hyperion, Dem Loa and Dem Rhea and their family on Vitus Grey Balianus B, Father Glaucus in the frozen air tunnels of Sol Draconi Septum, Kuchiat and Chiaku, and Kuchtu and Chichtiku, and the other Chichituk on that same world. Ania had been sure that Father Glaucus and our Chichituk friends had been murdered after we left that world, although she had never explained how she could know that. And I thought about others I had left behind, working my way back to my last sight of Grandam, and the clan members waving as I left for Home Guard service many years ago. And always, my thoughts returned to leaving Ania. I've left too many people, and let too many people do my work and fighting for me. From now on, I will fight for myself. If I ever find the girl again, I will stay with Ania forever. The resolution burned like anger through me, fueled by the hopelessness of finding another farcaster ring in this endless cloudscape.
"You know the one who teaches she has touched you?"
The words were not carried by sound nor heard by my ears. Rather, they were like blows to the inside of my skull, I literally reeled, gripping the sides of the kayak to keep from falling out.
Have you been touched, changed, learning to hear sea walk from the one who teaches?
Every word was a migraine blow, each struck with the force of brain hemorrhage. The words were shouted inside my skull in my own voice. Perhaps I was going mad. Wiping away tears, I peered at the giant cuttlefish and its swarm of green platelet parasites. The larger organism pulsed, contracted, extending coiling filaments, and swam through the chilly air. I could not believe that these words were coming from that creature. It was too biological, and I did not believe in telepathy. I looked at the swarming disks, but their behavior showed no more sense of higher consciousness than dust motes in a shaft of light, less than the synchronized shifting of a school of fish or the flocking of bats. Feeling foolish, I shouted, "Who are you? Who is speaking?" I squinted in preparation for the blast of words against my brain, but there was no response from the giant organism or its companions.
"Who spoke?"
I shouted into a rising wind. There was no answering sound except for the slap of the risers against the canvas of the parasail. The kayak slewed to the right, righted itself, and slewed again. I swiveled to my left, half expecting to see another cuttlefish monster attacking me, but instead saw something infinitely more malevolent approaching. While I had been focusing on the alien creature to the north, a billowing black cumulus had all but surrounded me to the south. Wind-tattered streamers of black whirled out from the heat-driven storm cloud and roiled under me like ebony rivers. I could see lightning flashing in the depths below and surging spheres of ball lightning being spit from the black column of storm. Closer, much closer, hanging from the river of black cloud flowing above me, curled a dozen or more tornadoes, their funnel clouds striking toward me like scorpion tails. Each funnel was the size of the cuttlefish monster or larger, vertical kilometers of whirling madness, and each was spawning its own cluster of smaller tornadoes. There was no way that my flimsy parasail could withstand even a close miss by one of these vortexes, and there was no way that the funnels were going to miss me. I stood up in the pitching, rolling cockpit, holding my place in the boat only by grasping a riser with my left hand. With my right hand, I made a fist, raised it, and shook it toward the tornadoes, toward the roiling storm beyond them, and then toward the invisible sky beyond. "Well, God damn you, then!" I shouted. My words were lost in the wind howl. My vest flapped around me. A gust nearly blew me into the maelstrom. Leaning far out over the hull of the kayak, bracing myself into the wind, like a ski jumper I had seen once on the ice shelf, caught in a moment of mad, poised balance before the inevitable descent, I shook my fist again and screamed, "Do your worst, goddamn you! I defy you, gods!" As if in answer, one of the tornado funnels came sidewinding closer, the lowest tip of its whirling cone stabbing downward, as if seeking a hard surface to destroy. It missed me by a distance of hundreds of meters, but the vacuum of its passing whirled the kayak and parasail around like a toy boat in a draining bathtub. Relieved of the opposition of the wind, I fell forward onto the slippery kayak hull and would have slid into oblivion if my scrabbling hands had not found a riser to grip. My feet were fully out of the cockpit at that moment. There was a hailstorm traveling with the passing funnel. Ice pellets, some the size of my fist, smashed through the parasail, pounded the kayak with a noise like fleshette clouds slamming home, and hit me in the leg, shoulder, and lower back. The pain almost made me release my grip. That mattered little, I realized as I clung to the pitching, dipping kayak, because the sail had been torn in 100 places. Only its canopy had saved me from being shot to bits by the hail, but now the delta-shaped foil had been riddled. It lost lift as suddenly as it had first gained it, and the kayak pitched forward toward the darkness so many thousands of clicks below. Tornadoes filled the sky around me. I gripped the now useless riser where it entered the battered hull and hung on, determined to complete that one act, hanging on until the boat, furled sail, and I were all crushed by pressure or shredded by the winds. I realized that I was screaming again, but the sound was different in my ears, almost gleeful. I had fallen less than a kilometer, the kayak and me gaining speed far beyond Hyperion's or Old Earth's terminal velocity, when the cuttlefish, forgotten behind and above me, made its lunge. It must have moved with blinding speed, propelling itself through the air like a squid jetting after its prey. The first I knew that it was hungry and determined not to lose its dinner was when the long feeding tendrils surged around me like so many huge tentacles, coiling and probing and wrapping. If the thing had tugged me to an immediate stop at the speeds the boat and I were falling, both kayak and I would have been snapped into small pieces. But the cuttlefish fell with us, surrounding the boat, sail, risers, and me with the smallest of its tendrils, each still 2 to 5 meters thick, and then it braked itself against the fall, jetting ammonia-smelling gases like a dropship on final approach. Then it began ascending again, up toward the storm where tornadoes still raged, and the central stratocumulus rotated with its own black intensity. Only half-conscious, I realized that the cuttlefish was flying into that roiling cloud, even as it reeled the bashed kayak and me toward an opening in its immense, transparent body. Well, I thought groggily, I've found its mouth. Risers and shreds of parasail lay around me and over me like an oversized shroud. The kayak seemed to be draped in drab bunting as the cuttlefish pulled us in closer. I tried to turn, thought of crawling back toward the cockpit and finding the Fleshhead gun, of cutting my way out of the thing. The Fleshhead gun was gone, of course, shaken out of the cockpit in all the violent tumbling and the fall. Also gone were the cockpit cushions and my backpack with the clothes, food, water, and flashlight laser. Everything was gone. I tried to chuckle, but the sound was not quite successful as the tendrils pulled the kayak and its clinging passenger the last 50 meters to the gaping orifice on the underside of the cuttlefish's body. I could see the internal organs more clearly now, pulsing and absorbing, moving in peristaltic waves, some of them filled with the green platelet creatures. As I was pulled closer, there came an almost overwhelming stench of cleaning fluid, ammonia, I realized, that made my eyes water and throat burn. I thought of Anea. It was not a prolonged or eloquent thought, just a mental glimpse of how she had looked on her 16th birthday, all short hair, sweat, and sunburn from her desert meditations. And I formed the single message. Sorry, kiddo. I did my best to get to the ship and bring it to you. Sorry. Then the long feeding tendrils curled and folded and pulled the boat and me up into a lipless mouth that I realized must be 30 or 40 meters across. I thought of the fiberglass and ultra-nylon parasail fabric and the carbon fiber risers that were entering with me and had time for a last thought. I hope some of this gives you a bellyache. And then I was pulled into the ammonia and fish smell, was vaguely aware that the air here in the creature's gut was not really breathable, decided to jump from the kayak rather than be digested, but lost consciousness before I could act or frame another coherent thought. Without my knowledge or observation, the cuttlefish continued to rise through cloud blacker than a moonless night, its lipless mouth closing and disappearing on its seamless flesh, the kayak and sail and me nothing more than a shadow in the fluid contents of its lower tract. Chapter 13. Kenzo Isozaki was not surprised when the Swiss Guard came for him. The Corps Helvetica colonel and 8 troopers in full orange and blue dress uniforms, with energy lances and death wands, arrived at the Taurus Mercantilis unannounced, demanded to see CEO Isozaki in his private office, and presented him with an encrypted disk key, ordering him to dress formally and appear before His Holiness, Pope Urban XVI. Immediately. The colonel stayed in sight of Isozaki as the CEO stepped into his personal apartment, quickly showered and dressed in his most formal white shirt, gray vest, red cravat, the double-breasted black demi-suit with the gold buttons on the side, and black velvet cape. May I phone my associates and issue business instructions in case I should miss meetings scheduled for later today? He asked the colonel as they stepped out of the lift into the main reception hall, where the troopers made a sort of gold and blue corridor between the workstations.
No, said the Swiss Guard officer.
A Pax Fleet Ram Scout was docked where Isozaki's personal ship was usually berthed. The Pax crew gave the Mercantilis CEO the briefest of nods, instructed him to strap into his acceleration couch, and then they were boosting in-system with two tor chips visible on the tactical holo display as they dropped into escort position. They are treating me as a prisoner, not an honored guest, thought Isozaki. His face revealed nothing, of course. But a wave of something like relief followed the pulse of fear and dread in him. He had been expecting this since his illicit meeting with Counselor Albedo, and he had slept almost not at all since that painful and traumatic rendezvous. Isozaki knew that there was no reason for Albedo not to reveal the fact of the Mercantilis's attempt to contact the Techno Corps, but he hoped that they would believe that it was his attempt and his alone. Silently, Isozaki gave thanks to whatever gods that wanted to listen that his friend and associate, Anna Pelikonyani, was out of Pacham's system visiting Renaissance Vector for a major trade fair there. From his couch between the Swiss Guard colonel and one of the troopers, Isozaki could see the tactical holo in front of the pilot's position. The sphere of moving light and color with its solid bars of code was highly technical, but Isozaki had been a pilot before these boys were born. He could see that they were not accelerating toward the world of Pacham, but toward a destination near the trailing Trojan Point, directly in the middle of the swarm of Pax Fleet asteroid bases and system defense forts. A Holy Office orbital prison, thought Isozaki, worse than Castel Sant'Angelo, where the virtual pain machines were said to run all hours of the day and night. In one of the orbital dungeons, no one could hear you scream. He was sure that the command to attend a papal audience was mere irony, a way to get him out of the Pax Mercantilis without protest. Isozaki would have bet anything that within days, perhaps hours, his formal suit and cape would be bloody, sweat-soaked rags. He was wrong on all counts. The Ram Scout decelerated above the plane of the ecliptic, and he realized their destination. Castel Gandolfo, the Pope's summer retreat. The disc-key viewer in the CEO's couch worked, and he called up an exterior view as the Ram Scout left its escorting torchships and dropped toward the massive potato-shaped asteroid. More than 40 clicks long and 25 across, Castel Gandolfo was a little world of its own. Its sky blue, its oxygen-rich atmosphere held in by Class 20 containment fields wrapped with infinite redundancies. The hillsides and terraces green with grass and crops. The sculpted mountains forested and running with streams and small animals. Isozaki saw the ancient Italian village pass below, and knew that the peaceful vision was deceptive. Surrounding Pax bases could destroy any ship or fleet in existence, while the interior of asteroid Castel Gandolfo was honeycombed with garrisons holding more than 10,000 Swiss Guard and elite Pax troopers. The Ram Scout morphed wings and flew the final 10 kilometers on silent electric pulse jets. Isozaki saw the Swiss Guard troopers in full battle dress rise to escort the ship the final 5 clicks. Rich sunlight glinted off their dynamic flow armor and transparent face shields as they encircled the Ram Scout and approached the castle at dead slow speeds. Isozaki saw several of the troopers aim probes at the ship, confirming with deep radar and infrared what the encrypted manifest readouts had told them about the number and identity of passengers and crew. A door opened in the side of one of the castle's stone towers, and the Ram Scout floated in, pulse jets cool, the Swiss Guard troopers tugging the aircraft into place with the blue glow of their lift packs. The airlock cycled. The 8 Swiss Guard troopers went down the ramp first, taking up their 2 lines as the colonel escorted Kenzo Isozaki out and down. The CEO was looking for a lift door or stairway, but the entire berthing level of the tower began to descend. The motors and gears were silent. Only the passing stone walls of the tower told of their movement downward and then sideways into the subterranean guts of Castel Gandolfo. They stopped. A door appeared in the wall of cold stone. Lights illuminated a corridor of polished steel with floating fiber-plastic lens pods, keeping watch at 10-meter intervals. The colonel gestured, and Isozaki led the procession down the echoing tunnel. At the end, blue light washed over them as other probes and sensors searched them inside and out. A chime rang, and another portal appeared and irised open. This was a more formal waiting room. 3 people stood when Isozaki and his escort entered. Damn, thought the Pax Mercantilis CEO. Anna Pelli Cognani was there, dressed in her finest fresh-silk robes, as were CEOs Helvig Aaron and Kenneth Hay Modino, Isozaki's other counterparts, on the Executive Council of the Pan-Capitalist League of Independent Catholic Transstellar Trade Organizations. Damn, thought Kenzo Isozaki again, his face staying absolutely impassive while he nodded silently to his associates. They are going to hold all of us accountable for my actions. We will all be excommunicated and executed.
This way,
said the Swiss Guard colonel, and opened an elaborately carved door. The room beyond was darker. Isozaki smelled candles, incense, and sweating stone. He realized that the Swiss guardsmen were not going with them through that door. Whatever waited there, waited for his party alone. Thank you, Colonel, said CEO Isozaki in a pleasant voice. With firm strides, he led the way into the incense-filled darkness. It was a small chapel, dark, except for red votive candles flickering in a wrought-iron stand against one stone wall, and 2 arched, stained-glass windows behind the simple altar at the far end. 6 more candles burned on the bare altar, while flames and braziers on the far side of the windows cast more ruddy light into the long, narrow room. There was only 1 chair, tall, straight-backed, velvet-cushioned, and placed to the left of the altar. In the back of the room was embossed what at first appeared to be a cruciform, but what, upon second glance, was revealed to be the triple cross of the Pope. The altar and chair were set upon a low stone dais. The rest of the chapel was without chairs or pews, but red velvet cushions had been set on the dark stone on either side of the aisle, down which M's Isozaki, Cognani, Hay Modino, and Aaron walked. There were 4 cushions, 2 on either side of the aisle that were not in use. The Mercantilis CEOs dipped fingers in the stone font holding holy water, crossed themselves, genuflected toward the altar, and went to their knees on the cushions. Before lowering his head in prayer, Kenzo Isozaki glanced around the tiny chapel. Nearest the altar dais knelt Vatican Secretary of State Simon Agostino Cardinal Lurdusami, a mountain of red and black in the ruddy light, his jowls and chins hiding his clerical collar as he bowed his head in prayer. And behind him knelt the scarecrow figure of his aide, Monsignor Lucas Odi. Across the aisle from Lodusami, the Holy Office's Grand Inquisitor, John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa, knelt in prayer, his eyes closed. Next to him was the infamous intelligence agent and torturer, Father Farrell. On Lord Asami's side of the aisle, 3 Pax Fleet officers were on their knees. Admiral Marjussen, his silver hair glinting in the red light, and his aide, Admiral Margaret Wu, and someone whose face it took Isozaki a moment to recall, Admiral Aldecacti. On the Grand Inquisitor's side of the aisle knelt Cardinal Dunoyer, prefect and president of Corps Unum. Dunoyer was a woman in her healthy 70s, standard, with a strong jaw and short-cropped gray hair. Her eyes were the color of flint. Isozaki did not recognize the middle-aged man in monsignoral robes who knelt behind the cardinal. The final four kneeling figures were the mercantilist CEOs, Aaron and Haymo Dino on the Grand Inquisitor side of the aisle, Isozaki and Peli Cognani on the Secretary of State side. Isozaki counted a total of 13 people in the chapel. Not an auspicious number, he thought. At that moment, a hidden door in the wall to the right of the altar opened silently, and the Pope entered with four men in attendance. The 13 people in the chapel rose quickly from their knees and stood with their heads bowed. Kenzo Isozaki had time to recognize two of the men with the Pope as aides, and the third as head of papal security, faceless functionaries. But the fourth man, the man in gray, was Counselor Albedo. Only Albedo stayed with the Pope as His Holiness walked into the room, allowing the kissing of his ring and touching the heads of the gathered men and women as they knelt again. Finally, His Holiness, Pope Urban XVI, took his seat in the straight-backed throne, with Albedo standing behind him. The 13 dignitaries in the room immediately stood. Isozaki lowered his eyes, his face remaining a study in calm, but his heart pounded at his ribs. Will Albedo expose us all? Have all these groups attempted secret contact with the Corps? Are we to be confronted by His Holiness and then taken from here, our cruciforms removed and then executed? Isozaki thought it likely. Brothers and sisters in Christ, began His Holiness, we are pleased that you have agreed to join us here this day. What we must say in this secret and silent place has remained a secret for centuries, and must remain within this circle until formal permission to share it with others is granted from the Holy See. We so abjure and command you upon the pain of excommunication and the loss of your souls to the light of Christ. The 13 men and women murmured prayers and acquiescence. In the recent months and years, continued His Holiness, there have occurred events both strange and terrible. We have witnessed these from afar. Some of these we have foreseen with the help of our Lord Jesus Christ, and many we have prayed would pass from us, sparing our people, our pax, and our church from a test of wills, faith, and fortitude. But events occur as the Lord wills them to occur. It is not possible for even His most faithful servant to understand all events and portents, only to trust in His mercy when those events seem most threatening and perplexing. The 13 dignitaries kept their eyes carefully downcast. Rather than relate these events from our perspective, His Holiness said softly, we shall ask some of those who participated in them to report in full. Then we shall endeavor to explain the connections between such seemingly disparate occurrences. Admiral Marjuson? The silver-haired admiral shifted slightly to face the others as well as His Holiness. He cleared his throat.
Reports from a world called Vitus Gray Balianus B suggest that we came close to capturing the Hyperion-born man named Rawl Endymion who eluded us, with our primary subject, the girl named Aenea. Almost 5 standard years ago. Elements of a special force of the Noble Guard.
The admiral nodded toward Pope Urban XVI, who lowered his gaze in agreement.
Elements of this special force, continued Marjuson, tipped our commander on Vitus Gray Balianus B to the possible presence of this person. Although he escaped before our search of the area was completed, we did turn up definite DNA and microtag evidence that this was the same Rawl Endymion who had been briefly incarcerated on the world of Mare Infinitus more than 4 years ago.
Cardinal Lord Usami cleared his throat.
It might be helpful, Admiral, if you described how the suspect, Rawl Endymion, escaped from this world of Vitus Gray Balianus B.
Kenzo Isozaki did not blink, but he registered the fact that Lord Usami was speaking for His Holiness in this conference.
Thank you, Your Excellency, said Admiral Marjuson. Yes, it appears that this Endymion both appeared on and escaped the planet via one of the ancient Farcasters.
There was no audible buzz in the room, but Isozaki sensed the psychic hum of interest and shock. There had been rumors for the past 4 years centering on Pax Fleet forces chasing some heretic who had managed to activate the dormant Farcasters.
"And was this Farcaster active when your men inspected it?" questioned Lord Usami. "Negative, Your Excellency," said Admiral Maruyasin. "There was no sign of activity on either Farcaster. The one upriver which must have granted the fugitive access to Vitus Grey Balianus B, nor the one downriver from the settlements. But you are certain that this Endymion had not arrived on planet by some more conventional means? And equally certain that he is not hiding there now?" "Yes, Your Excellency. This Pax world has excellent traffic control and orbital defenses. Any spacecraft approaching Vitus Grey Balianus B would have been detected light hours from the planet. And we would have turned the world upside down searching, administered truth-tell to tens of thousands of the inhabitants. The man named Endymion is not there. Witnesses did describe, however, a flash of light at the downstream Farcaster at the precise moment that our sensors in and above that hemisphere registered a major energy surge consistent with old records of Farcaster displacement fields." His Holiness raised his face and made a subtle gesture to Cardinal Lord Usami. "And I believe you have one other bit of unsettling news, Admiral Maruyasin," rumbled Lord Usami.
The Admiral's countenance grew grimmer as he nodded.
"Aye, Your Excellency. Your Holiness. This involves the first mutiny in the history of the Pax Fleet."
Isozaki again sensed the unspoken murmur of shock. He showed no emotion or reaction, but out of the corner of his eye he saw Anna Pelli Konyani glancing at him.
"I will have Admiral Aldecacti brief us on this matter," said Maruyasin.
He stepped back and folded his hands in front of him. Isozaki noted that Aldecacti was one of those stocky Lusian women who seemed almost too androgynous to label with gender. She was as solid and blocky as a brick in a dress uniform. Aldecacti did not waste time clearing her throat. She launched into an immediate briefing involving Task Force Gideon, its mission to attack Ouster strongholds in seven systems far in the outback, the successful outcome of that mission in all seven systems, and then the surprise in the final system, codenamed Lucifer. "To this point, the task force had performed beyond expectations and simulations," barked Admiral Aldecacti. "As a result, while completing operations in Ouster System Lucifer, I authorized a Gideon Drive drone to carry a message to Pacham, to His Holiness and Admiral Maruyasin, requesting permission to refuel and refit in Tau Ceti system and then extend Task Force Gideon's mission, attacking new Ouster systems before the alarm of our attack spread through the outback. I received Gideon drone permission to do this and proceeded to take the bulk of my task force to Tau Ceti system for refueling, rearming, and rendezvous with 5 additional Archangel starships which had come online since our task force had left Pax space."
"You took the bulk of your task force?"
queried Cardinal Lord Usami in his soft rumble.
"Yes, Your Excellency."
There was no apology or quavering in Aldecacti's flat Lusian voice. 5 Ouster torch ships had escaped our detection and were accelerating toward a Hawking Drive translation point, which would have presumably brought them out in another Ouster system. They would have spread the alarm of our task force's presence and lethality. Rather than divert the entire Task Force Gideon, which was approaching our own translation point to Tau Ceti system, I authorized HHS Gabriel and HHS Raphael to remain in Lucifer system just long enough to intercept and destroy the ouster torch ships." Lord Usami folded his pudgy hands in his robe. His voice was a deep purr.
"And you then translated your flagship, the Uriel, and 4 other Archangels to Tau Ceti system?"
"Yes, Your Excellency."
"Leaving the Gabriel and Raphael in Lucifer system?"
"Yes, Your Excellency."
"And you were aware, Admiral, that the Raphael was commanded by Father Captain de Sawyer, the same captain who had been reprimanded some years earlier for not succeeding in his mission of finding and detaining the child Aenea?"
Yes, Your Excellency.
And you were aware, Admiral, that Pak's fleet and the Holy See were concerned enough about Father Captain de Sawyer's, stability, that the Holy Office had assigned an undercover agent aboard the Raphael to observe and transmit observations on Father Captain de Sawyer's behavior and reliability.
A spy, said Admiral Aldecacti. Commander Leibler, yes, Your Excellency. I was aware that Holy Office agents aboard my flagship were receiving encoded tight-beam broadcasts from Commander Leibler aboard the Raphael.
And did these agents share any concerns or data from these broadcasts, Admiral Aldecacti?
Negative, Your Excellency. I was not made aware of the nature of the Holy Office's concerns related to Father Captain de Sawyer's loyalty or sanity. Cardinal Mustafa cleared his throat and raised one finger.
Lord Asami, who had been in charge of what Isozaki and the others had quickly recognized as an inquisition, glanced at the Pope. His Holiness nodded in the direction of the Grand Inquisitor.
I feel it necessary to point out to His Holiness and the other worthies in this room that observation of Father Captain de Sawyer had been approved, directed, from the office of the Holy See, with verbal authorization from the Secretary of State and Pak's Fleet Command, specifically from Admiral Maryusin.
There was a brief silence. Finally, Lord Usami said,
And can you tell us, Cardinal Mustafa, what the source of the shared concern had been?
Mustafa licked his lips.
Yes, Your Excellency, intelligence reports indicated that there might have been some chance of contamination during Father Captain de Sawyer's chase and rare contact with the subject named Anea.
Contamination?
Queried Lord Usami.
Yes, Your Excellency. It was our assessment that the girl named Anea had the power to affect both the physical and psychological makeup of those Pak citizens with whom she came in contact. Our concern in this instance was for the absolute loyalty and obedience of one of Pak's fleet's starship commanders.
And how was this intelligence assessment made, Cardinal Mustafa? Continued Lord Asami.
The Grand Inquisitor paused.
A variety of intelligence sources and methods were used, Your Excellency.
Lord Usami did not pause.
Among these were the fact that you have detained and, interrogated one of Father Captain de Sawyer's fellow shipmen from the aforementioned abortive chase of Subject Anea. Is that not correct, Cardinal Mustafa? Corporal Key, I believe.
Mustafa blinked.
That is correct, Your Excellency.
The Grand Inquisitor turned slightly, so as to speak to the others in the room, as well as the Pope and the Secretary of State.
Such detention is unusual, but called for in a situation which appears to affect the security of the Church and the Pax.
Of course, Your Excellency,
murmured Cardinal Lord Asami.
Admiral Aldecacti, you may continue with the briefing.
Some hours after my five archangels jumped to Tau Ceti system, said Aldecacti, and before any of us had completed our two-day resurrection cycle, a Gideon drone translated into Tau Ceti space. It had been launched by Mother Captain Stone.
Captain of the HHS Gabriel, said Lord Asami.
Affirmative, Your Excellency. The drone's encrypted message, encrypted in a code for my eyes only, said that the ouster torch ships had been destroyed, but that the Raphael had gone rogue, was accelerating toward an unauthorized translation point, and would not respond to Mother Captain Stone's orders to stop.
In other words, purred Lord Asami, one of His Holiness's Pak's fleet ships has suffered a mutiny.
It appeared so, Your Excellency, although in this case the mutiny seemed to have been led by the ship's captain.
Father Captain de Sawyer.
Yes, Your Excellency.
And were there attempts made to contact the Holy Office agent aboard the Raphael?
Yes, Your Excellency. Father Captain de Sawyer said that Commander Leibler was attending to duties. Mother Captain Stone thought this unlikely.
And when challenged about the changed translation point? Queried Lord Asami.
Father Captain de Soya answered that I had tight-beamed, changed orders to the Raphael prior to our task force's translation, said Admiral Aldecacti.
Did Mother Captain Stone accept this explanation?
Negative, Your Excellency. Mother Captain Stone closed the distance between the two archangels and engaged the Raphael.
What was the outcome of that engagement, Admiral?
Aldecacti hesitated only a heartbeat. Your Excellency, Your Holiness, because Mother Captain Stone had used an eyes-only encryption for her drone message, it was a full day in Tau Ceti system. The time it took for my emergency resurrection, before I read the message and authorized an immediate return to Lucifer system.
How many ships did you take with you, Admiral?
3, Your Excellency. My own flagship, the Uriel, with a fresh crew, and 2 of the archangels that had rendezvoused with us in Tau Ceti system. The Mikael and the Israel. I felt that the risk of accelerating resurrection of the Task Force Gideon crews was too great.
Although you accepted that risk yourself, Admiral, said Lord Usami.
Aldecacti said nothing.
What happened then, Admiral?
We jumped immediately to Lucifer system, Your Excellency. There we recycled under 12-hour automated resurrection. Many of the resurrections were unsuccessful. By combining the successfully resurrected crew members from all 3 ships, I was able to crew the Uriel. I left the other 2 starships in passive but automated defense trajectories while I commenced searching for the Gabriel and the Raphael. I found neither, but a final beacon drone was soon discovered on the far side of Lucifer's yellow sun.
And the beacon was from?
Prompted Lord Usami. Mother Captain Stone. The beacon held the downloaded history of the Gabriel's combat recorder. It showed the battle that had taken place less than 2 days before. Stone had attempted to destroy the Raphael by plasma and fusion weapons. The attempts failed. The Gabriel then engaged Father Captain de Soya's ship by death beam. There was silence in the tiny chapel. Isozaki watched the red light of the flickering votive candles painting the pained faces of His Holiness, Pope Urban XVI.
The outcome of that engagement?
Said Lord Usami. Both crews died, said Aldecacti. According to automated instruments aboard the Gabriel, the Raphael completed automated translation. Mother Captain Stone had ordered her crew to Resurrection Creche battle stations. She had programmed the Gabriel's ship computers to resurrect her and several of the essential crew members on an emergency 8-hour cycle. Only she and one of her officers survived the resurrection. Mother Captain Stone encoded the beacon and accelerated to the Raphael's former translation point. She was determined to seek out and destroy the ship, preferably before de Soya and his crew completed resurrection. If they were in their creches at the time of the death beaming.
Did Mother Captain de Soya know which system this translation point would open upon, Admiral?
Negative, Your Excellency. There were too many variables involved.
And what was your response to the beacon's data, Admiral?
I waited 12 hours for a working complement of the crews on the Mikael and the Israel to complete resurrection, Your Excellency. I then translated all 3 of my ships through the jump point indicated by the Raphael and Gabriel. I left a 2nd beacon for the archangels I was sure would be following from Tau Ceti system within hours.
You did not find it necessary to wait for these ships?
No, Your Excellency. I thought it important to translate as soon as all 3 of my ships were combat ready.
But you did find it expedient to wait for the crews of these 2 ships, Admiral. Why did you not give chase immediately with only the Uriel?
Aldecacti did not hesitate.
It was a command combat decision, Your Excellency. I felt that the probabilities were very high that Father Captain de Soya had taken the Raphael to an ouster system, quite possibly one more heavily armed than any task force Gideon had encountered. I also felt it probable that Mother Captain Stone's ship, the Gabriel, had been destroyed by either the Raphael or ouster ships within the unknown system. I felt that 3 ships of the line were the minimum force I could take into this unknown situation.
And was it an ouster system, Admiral?
Negative, Your Excellency.
Or at least no sign of ousters were discovered in the 2 weeks of investigation following this incident.
Where did the translation point take you, Admiral?
into the outer shell of a red giant star, said Admiral Aldecacti. Our containment fields were, of course, activated, but it was a very close thing.
Did all three of your ships make it, Admiral?
Negative, Your Excellency. The Uriel and Israel survived exit from the star and containment field cooling procedures. The Mikhail was lost with all hands.
And did you find the Gabriel and the Raphael, Admiral?
Only the Gabriel, Your Excellency. It was discovered floating free some 2 AUs from the Red Giant. All systems were inoperative. There had been a breach of the containment field, and the interior of the ship had melted into a single molten mass.
Were Mother Captain Stone and the other crew members found and resurrected, Admiral?
Unfortunately, no, Your Excellency. There was not enough discrete organic material remaining to pursue resurrection.
Was the slagging due to emergence in the Red Giant, or attack from the Raphael or Ouster Unknowns, Admiral?
It is still being determined by our materials experts, Your Excellency. But the preliminary report suggests an overload due to both natural and combat causes. The weapons used would have been consistent with the Raphael's armament.
So you are saying that the Gabriel fought an automated engagement near this Red Giant sun, Admiral?
Within the star, Your Excellency. It seems that the Raphael turned about, re-entered the star, and attacked the Gabriel within seconds of its emergence from Hawking space.
And is there a chance that the Raphael was also destroyed in this second engagement? The ship incinerated deep in the star?
A chance, Your Excellency. But we are not operating upon that assumption. It is our best guess that Father Captain DeSoya then translated out of system to an unknown destination in the outback.
Lord Asami nodded, his heavy jowls quivering slightly.
Admiral Marjussen, he rumbled, could you give us an assessment of this threat if the Raphael did indeed survive?
The older admiral stepped forward.
Your Excellency, we have to assume that Father Captain DeSoya and the other mutineers are hostile to the Pax, and that this theft of a Pax Archangel-class starship was premeditated. We also have to assume the worst-case scenario, that this theft of our most secret and lethal weapon system was carried out in coordination with the Ousters.
The Admiral took a breath.
Your Excellencies, Your Holiness, with the Gideon Drive, any point in this arm of the galaxy is only an instant away from any other. The Raphael could translate into any Pax system, even Pochum's, without the Hawking Drive wake warnings of the earlier and current Ouster spacecraft. The Raphael could ravage our mercantilist transport lanes, attack undefended worlds and colonies, and generally wreak havoc before a Pax task force could respond.
The Pope raised one finger.
Admiral Marjussen, are we to understand that this most prized of Gideon Drive technologies may fall into the hands of the Ousters, be duplicated, and thus power many of the enemy's ships?
Marjussen's already florid face and neck flushed more deeply.
Your Holiness, that is unlikely, Your Holiness, extremely unlikely. The steps of manufacture of a Gideon Archangel are so complex, the cost so prohibitive, the secret elements so guarded.
But it is possible, interrupted the Pope.
Yes, Your Holiness.
The Pope raised his hand like a blade cutting through the air.
We believe that we have heard all we need to hear from our friends in Paxfleet. You are excused, Admiral Marjussen, Admiral Aldecacti, Admiral Wu.
The three officers genuflected, bowed their heads, stood and backed away from His Holiness. The door whispered shut behind them. There were now 10 dignitaries present, in addition to the silent papal aides and Counselor Albedo. The Pope inclined his head towards Secretary of State Cardinal Lord Asami.
Disposition, Simon Augustino?
Admiral Marjussen is to receive a letter of rebuke and will be transferred to General Staff, said Lord Asami softly. Admiral Wu will take his place as temporary Pax Fleet Commander-in-Chief, until a suitable replacement is found. Admiral Aldecacti has been recommended for excommunication and execution by firing squad.
The Pope nodded sadly.
We shall now hear from Cardinal Mustafa, Cardinal Dunoyer, CEO Isozaki, and Counselor Albedo before concluding this business.
And thus ended the official inquiry by the Holy Office pertaining to the events on the Pax World of Mars, concluded Cardinal Mustafa. He glanced at Cardinal Lourdesami. It was at this time that Captain Womack suggested that it was imperative that my entourage and I return to the Archangel Jibril, still in orbit around that planet.
"Please continue, Excellency," murmured Cardinal Lourdesami. "Can you tell us the nature of the emergency which Captain Womack felt required your imperative return?"
"Yes," said Mustafa, rubbing his lower lip. Captain Womack had found the interstellar freighter that had uploaded cargo from the unlisted base near the Martian city of Arafat Kefia. The ship had been discovered floating powerless in Old Earth System's asteroid belt.
"Can you tell us the name of that ship, Excellency?" prompted Lourdesami.
"The HHMS Saigon Maru." CEO Kenzo Isozaki's lips twitched despite his iron control. He remembered the ship. His oldest son had crewed on it during the early years of the boy's apprenticeship. The Saigon Maru had been an ancient ore and bulk freighter, about a 3 million-ton ion sledge carrier, as he recalled.
"CEO Isozaki?"
snapped Lourdesami.
"Yes, Your Excellency."
Isozaki's voice was smooth and emotionless.
"The ship's designation suggests that it is of mercantilist registry. Is this correct, M. Isozaki?"
"Yes, Your Excellency," said the CEO. "But it is my recollection that the HHMS Saigon Maru was sold for scrap along with 60-some other obsolete freighters about 8 standard years ago, if memory serves."
"Your Excellencies," said Anna Pelikonyani. "Your Holiness, if I might..." The other CEO had whispered to her wafer-thin comlock and now touched her hearing.
"CEO Pelikonyani,"
said Cardinal Lourdesami. "Our records show that the Saigon Maru was indeed sold to independent scrap contractors some 8 years, 3 months, and 2 days ago, standard. Later transmissions confirmed that the ships had been scrapped and recycled at the Armagast Orbital Automated Foundries."
"Thank you, CEO Pelikonyani," said Lourdesami. "Cardinal Mustafa, you may continue."
The Grand Inquisitor nodded and continued his briefing, covering only the most necessary details. And while he spoke, he thought of the images he was not describing in detail. The Jibril and its accompanying torch ships slowing to silent, synchronized tumbling, matching velocities with the dark freighter. Cardinal Mustafa had always imagined asteroid belts as tightly packed clusters of moonlets. But despite the multiple images on the tactical plot, there were no rocks in sight. Just the matte black freighter, as ugly and functional as a rusted mass of pipes and cylinders half a click long. Matched as they were in velocity and trajectory, hanging only 3 clicks away with the yellow sun of humankind's birth burning beyond their sterns, Jibril and the Saigon Maru appeared motionless, with only the stars wheeling slowly around them. Mustafa remembered, and regretted, his decision to inspect the ship with the troopers who were going aboard. The indignities of suiting up in Swiss Guard combat armor, a Monomol D skin suit layer, followed by an AI neural mesh, then the spacesuit itself, bulkier than civilian skin suits with its polymer sheath of impact armor, and finally, the web belts of gear in the morphable reaction pack. The Jibril had deep radared the hulk 12 times and was certain that nothing moved or breathed on board. But the Archangel still backed off to 30 clicks attack distance as soon as the Grand Inquisitor, Security Commander Browning, Marine Sergeant Nell Kastner, former Ground Force Commander Major Piet, and 10 Swiss Guard Marine Commandos had jumped from the Sallyport. Mustafa remembered his pounding pulse as they jetted closer to the dead freighter, 2 commandos ferrying him across the abyss as if he were another parcel to carry. He remembered the sunlight glinting off gold blast visors as the troopers communicated with tight beam squirts and hand signals, taking up positions on either side of the open airlock.
two troopers went in first, their reaction packs throbbing silently, assault weapons raised. Then Commander Browning and Sergeant Kastner went in fast behind them. A minute later, there was a coded squirt on the tactical channel, and Mustafa's handlers guided him into the waiting black hole of the airlock. Corpses floating in the beams of flashlight lasers. Meat locker images. Frozen carcasses, red-striped ribs, gutted abdominal cavities. Jaws locked open in eternally silent screams. Frozen streamers of blood from the gaping jaws and hemorrhaged, protruding eyes. Viscera drifting in tumbling trajectories amid the stabbing beams of light.
"Crew,"
tight-beamed Commander Browning.
"Shrike?"
queried Cardinal Mustafa. He was mentally saying the rosary in rapid monotone, not for spiritual reassurance, but to keep his mind away from the images floating in hellish light before him. He had been warned not to vomit in his helmet. Filters and scrubbers would clean the mess before he strangled on it, but they were not foolproof.
"Probably the Shrike," answered Major Piet, extending his gauntlet into the shattered chest cavity of one of the drifting corpses. "See how the cruciform has been ripped out? Just as in Arafat Kefia."
"Commander!"
came a tight-beamed voice of one of the troopers who had moved aft from the airlock.
"Sergeant, here, in the first cargo hold!"
Browning and Piet had gone ahead of the Grand Inquisitor into the long cylindrical space. Flashlight lasers were lost in this huge space. These corpses had not been slashed and shattered. They were stacked neatly on carbon slabs extruding from the hull on each side, held in place by nylon mesh bands. The slabs came out from all sides of the hull, leaving only a zero-G corridor down the center. Mustafa and his guides and keepers floated the length of this black space, flashlight lasers stabbing left, right, down, and up. Frozen flesh, pale flesh, barcodes on the soles of their feet, pubic hair, closed eyes, hands pale against black carbon by hip bones, flaccid penises, breasts frozen in zero-G weightlessness, hair tight on pale skulls or floating in frozen nimbuses. Children with smooth, cold skin, extended bellies and translucent eyelids. Infants with bar-coated souls. There were tens of thousands of bodies in the four long cargo holds. All were human. All were naked. All were lifeless.
"And did you complete your inspection of the HHMS Saigon Maru Grand Inquisitor?"
prompted Cardinal Lourdesamy. Mustafa realized that he had fallen silent for a long moment, possessed by the demon of that terrible memory.
"We did complete it, Your Excellency,"
he answered, his voice thick.
"And your conclusions?"
"There were 67,827 human beings aboard the bulk freighter HHMS Saigon Maru," said the Grand Inquisitor. 51 of them were crew members. All of the crew members' bodies were accounted for. All had been slashed and rent in the same fashion as the victims at Arafat Kefia."
"There were no survivors?
None could be resurrected?"
"None."
"In your opinion, Cardinal Mustafa, was the demon creature called the Shrike responsible for the death of the crew members of the HHMS Saigon Maru?"
"In my opinion, it was, Your Excellency." "And in your opinion, Cardinal Mustafa, was the Shrike responsible for the deaths of the 67,776 other bodies discovered on the Saigon Maru?"
Mustafa hesitated only a second.
"In my opinion, Your Excellency,"